Let's see, where should we begin?
Maybe we should start with something practical. Would you be willing to go over what you were talking about this morning with us?
Sure.
Show us how to do that on the chart.
I will. Let me get a chart that we can use.
You're a great teacher. Have you been a teacher before?
I have. I've taught navigation.
Nancy and I had a sailing school for a number of years. And I've also taught in my profession at the University of San Francisco.
You mean your profession, meaning you've taught law?
Right.
Okay, so tell us what this chart is that we're looking at and why we're looking at it.
Well, this is a chart that shows an area from Fiji to Australia, Solomons and New Guinea, south to northern New Caledonia. And I just pulled this one out to review some of the things we talked about how we determine our position and how we use charts to navigate. The numbers on the right side of the chart that go up and down are degrees of latitude. And 1 degree of latitude is equal to 60 nautical miles, and 1 minute of latitude is equal to 1 nautical mile. So that's our basic scale we use to determine distance. The bottom scale and the top scale going across are longitude, and even though they're presented as parallels, longitudes are not parallel, but they actually meet at the poles. So at different latitudes, the distance of 1 degree of longitude varies. So we can't use it for actually determining a distance except right at the equator. So we have a GPS, a global positioning system, that tells us where we are. And that information is given to you as a degrees and minutes of latitude and degrees and minutes of longitude. So you take the numbers that are given to you on the GPS, and you find the equivalent place for them on the vertical sides of the chart, like 15 degrees, 30 minutes, for instance, would be right here. And then you can take that and go over to...
We better hold up because the fax is coming in, right? Is that what that sound is?
Yeah, that's the sound.
On to the next thing for the moment. Just thank you for your flexibility, Steve. It's really helpful getting all this. So can you explain to me, this is the weather fax that's coming in now, and I wonder if you can just explain to me what all these lines are that we're looking at.
Sure. These weather faxes are sent by radio into a machine that prints them out on charts, and I'm not the world's expert on weather, but it shows these lines are lines of pressure. And there's high pressure and low pressure. And basically, by measuring the distance between what they call, these are called isobar lines. And they're synonymous, kind of like a land chart that has lines that grade how steep a hill is. And you notice on those land charts, the closer together the lines are on a land chart, the steeper the grade, because those measure altitude changes over distance. So these measure pressure changes over distance, and it's a gradient. And therefore, the tighter and closer together the isobar lines are, the steeper the gradient. And that is, the more radical change in pressure over a shorter distance, which equates to wind. So
it equates to wind in what way?
And the high pressure moves to low pressure, I guess. And so high pressure flows into low pressure. And so the closer together the in distance that the change of atmospheric pressure is, the faster the wind's blowing. And then the wind tends to follow the direction of the lines of the isobars, but they're tilted about 15 or 20 degrees toward low pressure. And so what we do is we look at this chart that comes in and measure with a pair of dividers the distance between isobar lines in the area that we're sailing. So like on this one, we're up here in Luganville, so we measure, and that's measured by the latitude scale that is on the chart itself. And we can see that this isobar difference is about a little over 3 degrees. And depending on what your latitude is, that is how far north and south you are, that distance equates to wind speed. And I have in my radio book here a chart that's put out by the Weather Service in New Zealand, and it explains pretty much what I've said, and it shows at different latitudes what the displacing means. For instance, a 3 degree spacing near Fiji, which is 20 degrees south latitude, you can expect winds of 26 knots gusting to 39 knots. And then there's a correction around a high of an increase by 20%. And we are now under the influence of a high pressure area that yesterday was a really high pressure of around 1040 that's now coming off the Australian coast and moving toward New Zealand. And that high pressure system creates what they call reinforced trades. That is, the trade winds that normally blow in an easterly direction from the east to the west get accelerated because of this high pressure tends to squeeze together these isobars, forcing a steeper gradient over a smaller period of distance. So where we are right now, according to this weather facts, and we're a little north of 20 degrees. We're about 15 degrees 30 up here in Luganville. So that equates to more. So basically, you're looking at 25 to 35 knot winds out there today, which is one of the reasons that we've been waiting a couple days for the strong winds to go by. And in Fiji, they call the situation of a strong high creating reinforced trades a bogey wallow. One of my favorite terms.
Why is
terms.
It called a bogey wallow?
It's just a period of really high easterly, southeasterly winds caused by a big high pressure area coming off Australia. And as the high pressure is very high, if it gets above 1030, it's considered to be very high. And at its outside edges, it will create gale force winds. So that's what the weather chart shows us. We also look at the weather chart to see if there's any lows coming. This solid dark line is a trough line, and it's north of us. And the area around the trough, that's a trough of low pressure. And if you can look at these lines, the trough comes, it's kind of like a valley. And they call a ridge of high pressure, these curves here, this is the ridge line that comes right up where the ends of these things meet. And if you think of it as just as like a mountain cut sideways and use the isobar lines as if they were altitude lines, you'd have a shape kind of like my hands, and this ridge is what's coming right down there. And that's what's called a ridge of high pressure. So when you read in the newspaper, for instance, that there's a ridge of high pressure formed south of the islands, what they're referring to is this line that is formed by these edges here is south of here, and that's causing these increased trade winds. So by tomorrow, in our area, the trade winds will lighten, the seas will go down, and we'll have a much more pleasant journey up to Santa Cruz Island. So, and there's other, these lines are fronts. This is a cold front with the little triangles on it. This is an occluded front. And a very experienced weather person can deduce a lot more information off these charts than I can. And I sometimes try to listen to either the weather report or people on the radio describe what they're reading from the charts to help me learn how to read charts more. It's something I've spent, several years doing, but it's still a kind of an art form. And even these lines and how they're presented are just some person's view of it, or they have computer models that create these maps, but it's all basically guesswork. There's nothing really for sure. You could see something here and it could be wrong. It could show strong winds and the winds aren't quite so strong. And as this book said, the trade winds go in bands. So in an area that you average 30 knots, there'll be bands of 40 knots and bands of 20 knots. And it's not just a homogeneous type of thing. So you just use this to help indicate. We can see this dip right here over by Fiji where the trough's coming in. And you can see that the isobars there at that period, that place of dip just to the west of Fiji, is quite a bit smaller than what we have here. It's almost like 2.5 degrees. So those are definitely 35 to 40 knot winds blowing along the west coast of Fiji right now. And that's basically how we try to predict weather and how we try to pick a course that takes advantage of it or avoids the worst of it.
So when you get, first of all, how do you get these faxes? How do you know how to get them?
There's a transmission schedule, and there's a couple of different stations. You can get these from Honolulu, which we'll start listening to as we get further north, New Zealand and Australia. And each of them has their own time and frequencies, radio frequencies. And so I have two systems to get weather charts. One is this dedicated weather fax, they call it. This is a Furuno. And it has its own radio transceiver. And it's receiving a section, these radio signals, directly into this machine and prints out a chart. I also have a modem that's connected between my radio and my computer, and I can pull these same charts up on a computer screen. And you don't get a printout, but then you can save them on your computer screen. You can clean them up. We've been using this only because it's been getting a little better reception, and it's nice for everyone to have a piece of paper. But sometimes we run short of paper, and then we'll start using our computer. And since I didn't have an inverter until just recently, I wasn't using my computer because it would use up the battery and then I'd have to charge it up and stuff. So,
now when you look at this, how accurate do you consider it? I mean, what you're saying is this is a meteorologist's depiction of what they think is going on. But how big of a surprise are you ready for? When we go out into the ocean and you say, well, I'm predicting, what would you be predicting at this point, for example?
Well, if we were out sailing today on the east side of these islands, I'd be predicting 25 to 30 knots.
And so how big of a margin of error could you anticipate?
Oh, there? Maybe 20 or 25%.
Which means that the winds could be up to?
40 knots. And there'd certainly be gusts of 40 knots.
And how fast is a knot?
A knot is a nautical mile per hour. So it's a little bit, since a nautical mile is a little bit bigger than a statute mile, it's something like 8% or 10% more, like maybe 25 knots might be 30 miles an hour, just roughly something like that. So a mile per hour is a little less than a nautical mile per hour.
Okay. So 40 knots might be like 45 miles per hour.
Something like that. Yeah, and
that sounds like a strong wind.
It's a very strong wind. It's a wind that you wouldn't, even though this is a very strong boat, and we've sailed in stronger winds than that, The seas get 2, 3, even 4 meters in winds like that. It's very rough sailing. And for people who aren't experienced, it's not a very pleasant feeling. And the boat can be knocked around quite a bit, so you have to learn to hold on. And generally, we don't go out intentionally in gale force winds. That's winds over 35 knots. If we're in port and it starts blowing up that hard, we tend to wait for them to go down. For us, 20, 25 knots is a nice wind. You can go out and have plenty of wind and move along. This is a big, heavy boat, so it does like a certain amount of wind. But especially with people who aren't experienced, and I've taken lots of people like that sailing, I just find it safer to stay in the 20 to 25 knot range. And if the seas build up past that, unless there's a real important reason, we tend to stay in port. Now, if you're out in the ocean and the wind comes up, we reef the sails, that is, make them smaller, and the boat handles it just fine, and we don't, like, freak out or anything. But to intentionally go out and cause people distress, none of us would have our sea legs, so people might get seasick, and so why put everybody through that? But the problem with these charts up in our area is not that they leave a lot of detail out. If you compared this weather facts to the Fiji weather facts out of Nandi that is in the daily paper, you'll see that the weather facts out of Nandi has a lot more detail. It shows fronts. It puts cloud areas. You can look at this and can't tell whether our area right now is under clouds or not. We just see this trough line out here. If you compare this with the weather picture in the paper, you'll see this whole area that we're under is all marked as being cloudy. And that's the rain we're experiencing. Do you want to take a look at the 30-hour Prague? Now, the weather charts show either what you have now, but they also have prognosis. That is, they predict what they're going to look like in the future, and those are the most important. So we look at a 30-hour prog, that is 30 hours from now what the weather's going to be like, and then a 48-hour one, and then a 72-hour one. And the further you get, the more chance there's going to be inaccuracies, obviously, because they're guessing. Computer models can actually go 5 days out in advance sometimes now. It's just you start taking them with a bit of a grain of salt to further out, but the 30-hour prog is usually relatively accurate. And let's see. This shows, interestingly, a low developing over Fiji, and that's going to cause our wind.
So where are we on there?
We're right over here on this big part of Vanuatu. This is New Caledonia. This is all Vanuatu, and this is all Fiji. So this low is forming over western Fiji, and it looks like it's going to go south. And you can see this is the starting of it here. It's a trough, and these bends in the isobar are happening, and that's going to turn into a low. And the wind circulates clockwise around a low in the southern hemisphere, and counterclockwise around a high. So these winds turning clockwise around the high, they're going counterclockwise. So you can see that in this area, for instance, southeast of Fiji, just about the date line, there's very, very strong winds there. Out in front of this low, there's going to be winds in the 45 knot area. That's only about a 2 degree isobar span at 20 degrees, and according to our chart, a 2 degree span is 40 gusting to 60. So that's certainly something. But where we are, the isobars have widened significantly. So by tomorrow, we show right in our area about a 6 degree isobar now, almost twice as far apart as they were before, and that shows us gusts of 15 to 20, and that's just perfect sailing weather for us. So as long as this low continues off to the southeast, we can expect our winds to stay nice. And the direction, as you can see on this, the direction's coming south of east. So that'll be our direction, which will be good, kind of coming behind us. And we'll see what they predict the direction of this low is, because on the 48-hour and the 72-hour, it'll be plotted along. But experience shows these will move off to the east here, southeast, hopefully, and it doesn't turn around and come back over the top of us. So that's the only thing we'll keep an eye on as we get ready to go. But we'll get another fax in an hour. Will be the 48-hour Prague, and then at 1:45, 13:45, we'll get the 72-hour Prague and see what it is. So it looks great. There's going to be a lot of wind south of Fiji. The poor people that are coming up to Tonga and are making a passage based on this high pressure are really going to run into a lot of wind up there. And
have you heard of people doing that? Are there people in transit?
This happened earlier. When we came up, the very same situation happened. We were in Minerva Reef, which is southeast of Fiji, and cut our trip short because it predicted one of these lows to form. So we hurried up and got into Fiji before it formed. And then the boats coming after us, they, I guess, had rescue events of over 7 boats, and 2 boats were lost. And a couple of people abandoned ships, so there was quite a bit of heavy wind caused by, and it's the squash. You get a low squashing against the high, and it squeezes these isobars. It would be equivalent to a big valley versus a mountaintop. And so you have, again, a bigger gradient, they call it, a pressure gradient, over a shorter period of distance, and that causes real intense winds.
Very high tech.
It's wonderful. I mean, for a small boat sailor to have the capacity to have this kind of information is a really great safety thing, as well as allow you to predict. In the old days, way before we had any of this, I mean, the only weather was on the time channel. Of course, in those days, you had to navigate with a sextant. So you listened to the radio that would give you a time tick that would tick down the exact time. And on that station, there would be a 6-minute weather report every hour that would tell you whether there was any major cyclones, and that was it. So if there were no major cyclones, and you looked out and it was sunny, you went sailing, and you had no idea what was coming down the road. And in certain ways, it's there's no anxiety either, because you just sailed, and when the wind came up, you just reefed, and on you went. Now there's all this, with all this information we have, we feel compelled to pick weather windows, to wait for good weather, to be worried about things developing. And so it creates a little more, I don't know, stress, anxiety that we didn't have in the old days. Just went sailing and didn't worry about it. But now that you have it, it is high tech and it is very nice. And it's right on a small sailboat, can have this at a relatively modest cost.
So how much does a weather fax cost, and how much does it cost to keep it operating?
Well, actually, Terry, my friend Terry, gave me this one because he was given it, and he wasn't using that one at the time. So I've had this one now for like 15 years, but they cost about probably $1,500 or $2,000. And the high-frequency radio is about $1,500, I guess. And you can get a modem for a couple $100 hooked up to your computer.
How about the GPS?
And the GPS are cheap. You can get GPSs for under $100. This one that's permanently mounted, back when I bought it, was probably $250. We actually have a spare GPS in the chart table. Whereas a good sextant might cost $2,500 or $3,000. We have 2 sextants on board still, and we have the capacity, if we lose all our electronics, to navigate in the old way.
Now, what's this thing that you're holding in your hand and pointing at?
Oh, this is a set of dividers, and it's simply, they come in different forms. They look like the old compass, you know, where you used to be able to go like that. And it just allows you to measure distance by, again, going along the right-hand side or left-hand side, the latitude scale, measuring degrees or minutes, and then transferring it to another part chart, or likewise, you can take a distance. Like if we wanted to know what the distance was from where we're sailing tomorrow up to Nende, where we're going, let's just pick a distance like 2 degrees. That's 120 miles. And we can mark it off. That's 1, 2, and then that's 240 miles. And then we close down to the distance we are and measure that. And that's just about another 60. So it's about 300 miles from for our sail tomorrow. And that's what these are, dividers.
How long will it take us to do that sail under those conditions that we're predicting at this point?
Oh, a little over 2 days. If we leave, we'll leave in the morning, but we could get out here at nighttime. Sometime the night of the third day. If the winds are good, we can do 150, 160 miles a day. We will be there tomorrow, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. We could still be there Tuesday during the day because we definitely have the capacity to go 6-7 knots if the wind's blowing. So, and if we motor sail, I'm going to try to get in Tuesday. That would be my goal because I don't like to go into places at nighttime. So if we don't get in here by Tuesday before dark, we will have to just heave to, that is stop outside and wait for dawn. I don't go into new places, even with radar and GPS. It doesn't make any sense to go into new ports at nighttime. So we'll leave tomorrow morning, and that'll give us, and we'll either get up there Tuesday during the day or at the latest, probably Wednesday morning.
Now, looking at the chart between here and Lata, where we're headed to, do you see any cause for concern that anything that you feel like, well, we're going to have to watch out for that when we get there?
No, it's a pretty straight shot. I mean, there'll be the Torres Islands, which is the northern part of Vanuatu, just to the east of our course. And but that's actually almost a break, because if something happened or if somebody didn't feel well and we needed to stop, there are a couple of anchorages on the west coast. And so we could, if we had to, pull in. But no, I think generally we just miss the islands. We have a larger scale chart, that is a chart that shows a bigger island on the whole chart. And we will just use it. And as we navigate, we look at the chart. That's one of the reasons I like to use paper charts. And you physically mark your course on the chart, and it forces you to look to see if there's something in the way. And these blue circles and blue areas are shallower areas. And so you want to take a close look at what's there to make certain you don't hit something. But it looks to me like a pretty straightforward trip without a lot of problems in the way, especially if we went over up the west coast. It's a complete straight shot. If we come up the east coast, we'll have to make a decision which side of the Torres Islands to go on to, and we'll just decide that when we get up there.
Do you know anything about the prevailing current or the prevailing wind in this area between here and Lata?
Yes, and it's shown on the charts, and also we have pilot charts that give us more detailed information. I'm just looking at this chart. Doesn't have any particular current shown on it. If you'd like me to, I can pull a pilot chart out, and it can show you the expected wind, the average winds, and the average currents for the area. Usually the ocean charts themselves will have arrows on them and show you areas of current, but this chart, let me see the one that we made up, whether this shows any currents in it or not. See here in the Bougainville Strait, it will show you, these arrows are current lines. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that shows a pretty strong current. Here it says 3 to 4 knots going in that direction. these marks here show there could be tides, riptide kind of things, or overfalls caused by the strong current coming through the Bougainville Channel. If you had a large-scale chart of our channel here, which we have, you'd see quite a bit of current. Here's a current line showing 1, 2, 3, 4 knots of current maximum coming up through the Saigon Channel. And so that's...
The Saigon Channel is where we are now?
Is this channel right
here.
Oh,
I see.
Yeah.
So that's...
And then showing up here, they'll generally be in the whole South Pacific, the whole ocean and the wind moves from east to west. So you can expect some kind of following current, maybe a half a knot, anytime you're sailing, just because the prevailing trade winds are always blowing from east to west.
Does that ever change?
Does it
change north to south? Or?
Mainly, then it blows westerly sometimes. I mean, the Polynesians got all the way from Asia to Easter Island, not sailing easterlies, but sailing westerlies. And at different times of the year, there are westerly winds, and these lows that come across will produce westerly winds in certain quadrants. And that's what the navigators of old were very good at, recognizing weather patterns and knowing this is a period of westerlies. We're going to have 3 weeks of westerlies. And so we're going to take those to move in an easterly direction. Nobody, including ancient mariners, would take off to go east when it's blowing 30 knots out of the east. I mean, nobody does that. They didn't do it then. We don't do it now. So
are there other things that you wanted to show me about the charting?
That was nothing. I think we talked earlier just about how everybody seems to misunderstand the scale of a chart and the smaller land area that's shown on the larger chart is a larger scale chart. That is, a harbor chart is a larger scale chart than an ocean chart. And that's kind of counterintuitive because people look at the big ocean and think it's a larger scale chart. But that's because the scale, 1 to 300,000, is larger than 1 to a million. And both of those are smaller than 1 to 50,000, just like a fraction. So that the more detail that's on the chart, and the larger the scale. That was something else. We talked about the compass rows. When we choose a course, we use the chart and we put our position on the chart, and then we use a pair of I use a pair of triangles. There's various ways that you parallel lines, and you draw the line that you want to do a course, and then you take that line and go up to this compass rose, which shows you the points around the compass. And I'd showed you on the larger scale chart, there's a magnetic compass rose in the middle that's adjusted for magnetic variation, which right around here is about 12 degrees to the east, which means that 12 degrees true is zero magnetic. And so you take that course line and you put it up against the compass rose, and you can read what the compass course is supposed to be for you to stay out of trouble. And that's what we do. We plot a course line. We get a compass course that is along that line. And then we periodically position fix to see how we're doing against that line, because there might be a current acting on you that pushes you one way or another off that line, and you adjust your steering and you therefore try to stay on a line. And if there's no rocks or dangers on the line you pick and you stay on the line, then either day or night you can rest pretty assured that you're not going to hit something. Our charts are very wonderful. Most of the time and most of the areas we cruise, we don't have to worry too much about uncharted dangers. I'm sure up in the area we're going, that won't be the case. And you have to use sunlight and visual navigation. So I imagine amongst the Reef Islands and even the Duff Islands, there'll be a lot of daytime, midday, where the sun is relatively high, so you can see any discoloration in the water.
So how well is the Pacific chart? The part of the Pacific that you sail in
is very adequately charted, I would say, and all the way through the Pacific. The problem with it is that it was charted way before GPS. And so the GPS positions sometimes don't coincide with the chart. In other words, it's been a big, the Earth is not a round ball. Yet they have to come up with a round ball theory to make charts. And it's called the map datum, which model they use to approximate a globe. And GPS is based on a datum. Some of the Admiralty charts are based on a different datum. American charts might be based on a different datum. French charts might be different. So you still have to be careful if you're using your GPS to put yourself on a chart that, in fact, they're sharing the same datum. And modern charts will tell you, like, what correction to make to make it match your GPS. And you find that up on the top of these charts, usually, there'll be a correction that'll say, for instance, in this area, the pilot chart will say, if you want to correct your GPS position to be able to put directly on this chart, you have to correct it 0.43 minutes east and 0.23 minutes south, let's say. This must be an older chart, this one I'm actually using. But that one that we were just looking at that we copied, this is based on an Admiralty chart. And it will definitely have on it a correction. And here it is right here. It says satellite-derived positions. Positions derived from satellite navigation are normally referred to as WGS datum. Such positions should be moved 0.27 minutes southward and 0.43 minutes westward to agree with the chart. So when you get a number, for instance, off your GPS, you have to correct it before you put a mark on the chart. And what that means is, when we came in the Segun Channel, for instance, the position showed us closer to the reef than we actually were. And we were actually in the middle of the channel, but if you put the marks directly on the chart, it showed you what it is. So even though the charts themselves are relatively accurate, most of them were all made way before modern navigation age. So they can still be off a mile. I've seen islands a mile out of place using your GPS. So there's just no substitute for constant visual vigilance and constant plotting. But once you get to an area and you get to a light, let's say, and you correct that light for your GPS and make whatever correction it is, then you can rely pretty much on the chart to get you around.
Would you be willing to show me your sextant and give a brief kind of... Is it hard? Would it be hard to explain how to use it in a sort of...
Well, you know, not really. The sextant just basically measures the angle of a heavenly body to you. That is, if the horizon is straight out and you go up to a heavenly body, it's this angle right here. So for instance, if something's directly overhead, it's 90 degrees. If it's halfway on the horizon, it would be 45 degrees. So the sextant itself simply measures, and you can turn it sideways and you can measure angles between two points. It's just an angle measurer is all it does. And the system of celestial navigation that we use is actually pretty simple to understand. You go from a pre-selected position, not where you are, but let's say you just go to any two places, 15 degrees south and 175 east. A nice, no minutes, just a nice round thing. You can look in a book, and that book will say if you're at that position, this heavenly body, let's say Sirius, will have an altitude of 32 degrees, which means that if Sirius is here, 32 degrees, let's say, would be like that. Any place on this circle underneath Sirius that's a cone with 32 degrees, you could possibly be on that circle. Because you're looking at a star that has an altitude of 32 degrees, and any place, it's like a cone, any place on the perimeter of that cone pointing up to the top of the cone is the same angle. So what they do is you measure the angle you've gotten from the angle it gives you from that position. And if the angle you've gotten is smaller, that means that you are further away from the point directly underneath the heavenly body. If the angle you get is greater, you're actually closer to, right? If you got 90 instead of 45, you'd be right directly underneath it. So you take that difference and you basically plot it. And instead of a circle, because we're dealing with such a short distance, you're dealing with a line. So you have to first get the angle of the heavenly body at an exact time. And then you look in the book and find out where that star would be at some location near you that's a rounded number. And you simply compare your angle to that angle. And then that becomes the difference, becomes an intercept, they call it. And you measure that either away from your point or toward your point, depending on whether it's a bigger angle or a smaller angle, and you plot one line. So for each heavenly body, you can only get what they call one line of position. It's not enough to tell you where you are, because you could be any place along that line. The nice thing about stars is you can take four or five of them at the same time, and therefore you can get these lines of position to cross, and where they all cross is where you are. And so usually you don't cross directly in a point, you cross in a little triangle, because there's little errors, and you estimate your position someplace in the middle of that triangle.
What's this book that gives you?
There's two. They use the Nautical Almanac, which gives you information about the position of the star or the heavenly body. And then we have tables that were worked out during the war for pilots, so they could rapidly determine their position, because pilots used to use celestial navigation too. And it's called HO249, Hydrographic Office Publication 249. And it gives you pages and pages of numbers. And you go into that book with information that you get out of the Nautical Almanac. And you go across little things. And it gives you a bearing. And, you know, it'll give you a bearing, that is, the direction that that heavenly body is from this assumed position, and an altitude. And so you plot that, and then you compare, like I say, what you actually get to that, and that ends up becoming one line that you plot on either directly on a chart, or we actually use plotting sheets, because you'd mark your chart up every day with lines. And that's basically how you do it. Now with the sun, you can determine your latitude by knowing the altitude of the sun at its highest. You don't need to know time to know your latitude. That's why the ancient, even European navigators, could always determine their latitude, because that's the distance north or south they are. Because there's a formula you work out from just when the sun gets near noon, you just shoot the angle, and then it flattens out, and then it starts going down. And if you know what that angle is, you will be able to determine your latitude. But it's longitude that has always been the bugaboo, how far east or west you are. And that required a chronometer that was... there's a whole story. There's a book out called Longitude that's really wonderful about the Harrisons and how they developed the chronometer in the 1760s. But it was only until like the 1760s that we had any real accurate. There were really long, complicated mathematical ways called lunars that people tried to get their longitude, but the reason so many European ships and everything crashed on the land is they would run down there, they'd get on a latitude and they'd keep going until they tried to get to some place. And so there's a whole story about the Board of Longitude, and there's a great, really interesting book written on the history of determining longitude at sea.
So the system, the simple, the non-GPS system of navigating that you use sounds like it's an amalgamation of different systems that have been put together over time.
It is. In itself is an advanced system that's a lot easier for us than the old way. The traditional way was you'd work this all out long trigonometry, you know, with trigonometry. Each site was its own trigonometric problem where you solve what they call a celestial triangle. And it gets so complex it would take years to learn it. I was doing navigation with a sextant even before I understood what I was doing. The concept of the cone and position away and toward and what you were actually doing only came to me slowly after a few years of doing it. But because it's kind of a cookbook situation, you can actually take your sight, go through numbers, go through the books, work out your position without necessarily understanding everything that you're doing. So, but sailing used to require more of an apprenticeship than it does now, because there's so many labor-saving devices and electronic ways that people now just jump on their sailboats with very little experience and go off sailing. Whereas in the older days, like 25 years ago, it was too dangerous to do that. You had to sail with other people. You had to race on crews. You had to, you know, get trained, take courses in navigation and various things.
So when did you start sailing? When did you?
Ocean sailing, I started in law school. I built my first sailboat in seventh grade wood shop.
And, so I'm assuming that was more than 25 years ago.
Yeah, I'm going to be 59 this summer. So it was, 64, probably 61 or 60, maybe 60. Or even younger than that, anyway. And I built a little sailboard for some reason that I saw an article in a Mechanics Illustrated magazine. And I built this thing as my woodshop project. And then surfing started, so my friends were all making their surfboards. In those days, everyone had to make their own surfboard. And we'd go off to the beach, and I'd sail my little boat, and they'd sail their... and do their surfing, and my friends named that boat the Little Stevie Wonder, I remember, because Stevie Wonder had just cut his first song, and he was 12 and we were 13, so they all thought that was my first boat. And then I built a catamaran, a 14-foot Piver catamaran in high school, and sailed it some, and then it was in later college and law school, I started ocean racing and crewing on other boats, and then I got Gershon 1... a boat before Gershon 1 probably when I was 25 and had it for a couple years. And then I got Gershon 1 and did my first ocean crossing in 1977.
Now, who was responsible for teaching you the navigation and your boat skills and your sailing skills?
Just experience. I sailed with other people. And the first time we took Gershon 1 up and down the California coast, we brought a real experienced sailor with us. And we put a number of years in. I mean, it was probably, I had 10 years of ocean sailing before I took my own boat on a trip to Hawaii, let's say. All with more experienced people, all with people who taught me. We took navigation classes, and I was navigating on other people's boats before we took our own boat.
Oh, so you took classes.
Yeah, and then I took classes, too, that taught us how to do it. And... yeah, just mainly experience. And then Gershon 1 was a 32-foot Lapworth design wood boat. And I lived on her and sailed her for 18 years. And did a lot of cruising in the Pacific, went as far as Tonga and several trips to Polynesia.
By yourself? Or?
I did one single-handed trip from Santa Barbara to Kona.
How was
That was good. I was older. I'd already had 10 years of ocean sailing experience. I was probably 38 or 40 at the time. And I was a little bit unsettled the first day or two being out on the ocean by yourself. But then I got into a routine and really enjoyed it. And the boat did really well. And read and wrote a lot. Got really connected to the ocean.
So when I've never understood how people do ocean sailing single-handedly.
You have to violate the rules of the road, basically. You can't keep a watch all the time. And so I would just, coming from the mainland to Hawaii, you don't really involve too many shipping lanes. You come south of the shipping lanes. So I decided that fatigue was a bigger danger than getting hit by a ship. And so I would just sleep from midnight till 6 in the morning. And then I just had this thing, if I ever rolled over in the middle of the night, I'd jump up and look around. And I had an electronic device that picked up radar and would set off a siren like a cop buster. And so I had something, they make that for boats. And I had something like that on board that would receive signals from radar. So the idea being if a ship came.
If another radar came in your range.
Right, then it would set off an alarm. And there's just a certain, I don't know, I didn't have trouble sleeping. Like I say, fatigue is a bigger danger than getting hit by something. But you're not supposed to. The rules of the road require you to keep a vigilant lookout at all times. And all these races that have all these single-handers are clearly violating the rules of the road. And if you get in a collision with another boat as a single-hander and you're not on watch, you are held completely responsible.
What do you think is the motivation to do single-handed sailing? Why do people want to do it? Why did you want to do it?
It's funny, I had entered the single-handed race, the Trans-Pac single-handed race, because I felt I was experienced enough to do it. And then I didn't have an engine on my boat in those days, and we had really rough weather getting from Southern California up to the start of the race, and I missed the race. And so I had, I started having doubts that maybe I set that whole thing up just so I'd miss the race so I wouldn't do it. So I felt compelled to do it just to make certain I could do it. And I don't think I enjoy sailing with a mate a lot more. Cheryl is much more fun to sail with. Sometimes people single hand because they can't get along with anybody. Some people are so persnickety about their boat, they just can't let somebody else do something another way. And they get in such conflict sailing with people that they have to sail alone. People end up sailing alone because they have to deliver a boat from A to B and can't find good crew. There's a various reasons why. But I think at some point people like the idea of just attaining something. It's like somebody doing a solo climb or something you're just doing by yourself as opposed as a part of a team.
How long did it take you to get from Santa Barbara to Honolulu?
I came right into Kona.
Oh.
It took me 19 days.
That sounds very fast. Is that unusually fast?
No, it was. I actually had 3 days of calm weather. It could have even been 16 days. But the trade winds are good. I'd never gone 24 hours without talking to somebody. We had no high seas radio. It wasn't like I had sat phone and high seas radio. I had a VHF radio that had a 20-mile range and an old AM radio that I could get Radio Mystery Theater on the radio for about 900 miles. And after that, I had no human voice at all. I remember coming into Honolulu, the Coast Guard was coming in, so I thought I would have this nice-sounding woman. So I thought I'd just chat her up one morning coming through the Alanui-Haha Channel from the east at about 6 in the morning. So I got all excited about talking to her, you know. So I was going to do the guise of a radio check. You know, calling the Coast Guard for a radio check, and they just said, "Hi, how are you? Nice morning, blah, blah." So I called her up and said, "Calling for a radio check." She goes, "Loud and clear, click." So no contact at all. So
much for expectations.
Yeah, but I had a real interesting experience. I was so in tune with the ocean. When we came down through the channel, it was real windy, of course. And then you hit the wind line off of Kauai High up there. I'd stayed up all night, so I was kind of getting tired. So I put up light sails, and I was drifting along, and I'd start taking naps, and then I'd wake up. And on one of my naps, I heard the radio talking, and I jump up, oh God, I'm sleeping too long, and I wake up, and the winds come up, and I'm just 200 yards from Kahole Point at the airport, and the boat is just creaming right at the point, you know, so I say, God, jump up, you know, change course and get away and everything. And then I look around, I'm going to call the guy who alerted me on the radio to thank him, and there was just nobody around.
What was that all about?
You tell me. It was, I think, some sense of something. I mean, we all have levels. I mean, it was, I'm that person, as you heard last night, who believes in too much spooky stuff, but...
So you were sleeping?
Yeah.
And you heard somebody on the radio alert you?
Wake up. And I woke up. And so obviously, since there was no boats around, it had to be something internal. And something in my body felt the motion coming off the land or something. And that's why people single-handed sail. Maybe they get so in tune with just the natural rhythm. You don't talk to other people. You can sit down and read a book from start to finish and not get up. I read the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I remember on that trip, I just started reading it one morning, and I didn't have anything to do. I read it for 20 hours straight, or however long it took me to read it, and that was kind of interesting. I really enjoyed it. I wrote really a lot about it. Unfortunately, I later lost all the writing I did on that trip.
Now, Ariva, how are you doing time-wise?
Good.
Which came first, the Gershon 2 or Cheryl?
Gershon 2.
When did you build? You built the Gershon 2.
I bought her as a, she was a steel hull, completely empty. Half, you know, just the hull outside was finished. And I took over the project in about 1990. And we launched her in 91. But she didn't have an interior at all, just big floor and no winches. We used trucker hitches on our halyards. Everything real simple, but I wanted to keep sailing. I'd run out of money, and I had to launch the boat and start sailing it. And we just put futons up on the wall. And this was all just flat steel. There was none of this stuff in here at all. And one little stove. We had one little camp stove. We used to have an aluminum ladder that was tied up there to come down. And all the foam was open. There was no ceiling in or anything. And so then over the years, I just kept improving her, and friends would help, and finished her. So we've been sailing her now about 15 years.
So somebody started building her in Kona.
Honolulu.
In Honolulu.
Sand Island.
And got as far as finishing the hull, just the exterior shell.
Right.
Of the hull.
And that boatyard, the builder, was concerned because the... This was a retired airline pilot. He had no real sailing experience. I think it was too big of a boat for him. He had no idea how big of a project it was. And then his wife got sick, and their dream fell apart. And Alex Jacobenko, who was the master boat builder who built it, was worried that he was going to get stuck with this boat. And so he had tried to talk me into it for a while, because I wanted one of his steel boats. He's a great steel boat builder. And so he talked me into taking over the project and finishing it.
I'm sorry. Why a steel boat? Why is there an advantage to having a steel boat?
Well, number one, it's strong. Number two, it's strong. And number three, it's strong. And it there's things out on the ocean. There's the ocean's becoming polluted. And there's a lot more junk in the ocean than there was when I started sailing 30 years ago.
What kind of junk?
I mean, containers. Flotsam and jetsam, junk that boats throw overboard, things that could punch a hole in a wood boat. And I had a wood boat for 18 years, and I would sometimes suffer anxiety that I'd be sailing along in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, and realized if I bounced off something, it could punch a hole in the boat, and the boat could sink, and there I'd be. And, of course, it never happened, and you live with that little thing in the back of your mind. And I always just had this idea that I'd love a boat that you just didn't have a worry like that, that you could take it and reinforce 30 or 40 knot trades and just sail her hard and not worry about it. And so I started looking for a smaller steel boat 40 foot is what I thought I could do. And anyway, ended up with this project and that I'm still in the middle of.
What do you mean you're still in the middle of it?
I mean, we still haven't finished. There's trim, all these pukas, the holes that have curtains on them could all have trim and nice cane doors. And all these edges of the bulkhead, I actually have milled all the, see like this trim here? I've milled all this stuff, and I have all corners and all the straight pieces to do all the edges and to do the inside of the lockers and that kind of stuff. But she's pretty finished now, enough that where I'm not that concerned about. It's really comfortable. We consider her real comfortable ocean-going boat right now. So.
It's a beautiful boat.
So.
Do we need to stop? Is there a fax coming in?
Yeah, there's a fax coming in.
Okay.
Gee, that was a run-on. That took, we were an hour, right? Cause it's
is
like
that
a,
how long it's
been? Yeah, the backhoe is hard to work with. And this was available a lot, and I wanted to keep a matching wood. This is more, and none of this is stained. This is all just varnished. It's a beautiful red, yeah. And the grain is real even and smooth on it.
It's pretty.
And so we've done everything in the Honduras mahogany. Now, unfortunately, it's harder to find as good a Honduras mahogany.
Mm, yeah, I bet. Yeah. Wow. Cool. So when did they come up with a sextant?
Oh, it's been the development. There was an astrolabe. They've been around since the 18th century.
Uh-huh.
And what you do is you use these mirrors, and if you have a heavenly body, you end up bringing it down to a horizon, and then you read what the angle is off of here.
Uh-huh.
And then to do time, I've got this nifty, this is my little pet here, it's a nifty stopwatch. And what it does is kind of a sports watch, and you can start it, you get to like the radio goes tick, 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 tick. At the time it will be, at the tick it will be, so, you know, such and such a time, beep. So you start it, and then you write down the time. Let's say you started it at 13:52. And then you go out on deck and you're taking your sextant shot of your first star. And you get it just where it's on the horizon and you go boom. Well, you can record the time of your first shot. Let's say at 16 seconds, you add it to your time. But the elapsed time keeps going. So then you can go back and catch up again and do your second shot, all staying on deck. In the old days, you'd have to run down the radio each time and restart your stopwatch on another time tick. This allows you to take a number of different shots, record the time separately, and then catch up again. And so this is a neat little toy. Maybe we'll get to go out to sea. We'll pull this out, and I'll show you how to do all this.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
If you'd find it interesting.
I do. I find it really interesting. A big piece of equipment would be hard to come by for your average poor guy out at sea. I mean, if you didn't have for fishermen, for example.
You can buy a first sextant when I came across from Hawaii. I bought a plastic sextant at a flea market for $5.
Really?
And I have a plastic backup that I use for rough weather so I don't get this all wet. And even there, they're a couple $100 now, but you can find used ones. I know people who sail who have never had any money and get it together. I mean, we have a friend, Bruno, who we've put together a couple of boats and just been able to do it without any money, or very little money and hard work. You don't really need a Tamiya sextant to navigate. That was something that came my way from a sailor who bailed. He'd bought all the equipment, did one ocean crossing, and decided he didn't like it, and unloaded all his stuff. And I'd always just use plastic sextants. I mean, like I said, my first plastic sextant cost me $5. And then I finally splurged and bought one at the time that cost $80. And then I got this Tamaya. It's really just an aesthetic thing. It's like any other. It just feels nice. It's heavy. It's a nice piece of equipment. It all is smooth, and it's not needed. It's just an aesthetic thing that I was lucky enough to be able to acquire. But I've had this sextant for probably 25 years.
That's great. Well, it's really interesting to me to get a really good rundown on all of this.